He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves, that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, "God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give tithes of all that I get." But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift his eyes to heaven and beat his breast, saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." I tell you, this man went down to the house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. May God bless this reading of his word.
I got you. Thank you. Hope for the hopeless. Rest for the weary, all that you're needing. Man, what a great song. What a great song. All that you're needing, he is. It's kind of hard to believe until you come to the end of yourself and you discover it to be true. So I don't know where you are this morning, but we offer Christ to you. And he is enough. Today is our last Sunday in the parables. If ever there was a parable written for the established church, this is it. And I would love to somehow recapture the shock factor of this. So, because in the first telling of it, it was shocking what Jesus said. The parables are those kinds of stories. Let me offer this modern retelling, which I've adapted from another pastor for our context. It goes like this. Are you ready? Two men went to church on Sunday morning, Jack and John. Jack knew his way around. He'd grown up there, Sunday school, Awana, Upward, the whole thing. He knew his parents would be there that day, and so he wanted to be sure they saw him, so he went in up at the front and sat down. He bowed his head, and he shut his eyes. He'd seen his dad do that once, and he knew that it was holy. You see, Jack was a young man who took his religion very seriously. He carried a big Bible, never missed a church service. He liked the image of being a highly principled young man, unlike his peers. He never exceeded the speed limit, never tasted alcohol, never smoked, avoided drugs, and was extremely self-righteous about his sexual purity. As Jack reflected on his life before the 11 a.m. service that day, he kind of swelled up with a sense of self-confidence. I'm feeling pretty good about this church thing. Nothing to confess, nothing to feel ashamed about. I've done nothing wrong. Good grief. It couldn't be. Out of the corner of his eye, Jack saw John. John from the neighborhood, and thought to himself, what on earth is he doing here? He gambles and drinks and cheats on his college girlfriend. He doesn't belong here. In the back, John was thinking the exact same thing about himself. What am I doing here? I don't belong here. And the more he thought about it, the more uncomfortable he got just being there. He looked around nervously as if someone in charge would appear at any moment and tell him he had no business being here. He was unsure where to sit or if there was some special ritual he should observe upon entering. Didn't Christians cross themselves before they sat down, or was it Muslims? He didn't know. He couldn't remember. So John slid cautiously to the very back row and replayed the tape over the last 3 days. Kicked out of the house for stealing again from his mom's purse. Lost his job the day before that because he couldn't show up on time. Hangovers do that. And then the breakup with Julie last weekend, who told him to get the blankety blank out of her life because she cheated on him with Susie again. All of this brought him to the end of himself and to the stark realization of the mess that he was making of his life. There, sitting on the back row, he began to feel dirty, guilty, filled with shame, hopeless. And then all at once, it hit him, and tears filled his eyes as he buried his hands into his face and said, "Oh God, help me. I'm done." I tell you, it was John who went home justified that day. Not Jack. Jesus shocked his listeners with this story. Two men, two prayers, two destinies. Two men. Two very different ways to pray. Two destinies. Pick up in verse 9 with me, because this is important. It's important. Well, let me ask you, why would you see verse 9 as important beyond, right, it's included in the scriptures and we take every verse seriously. But like, what's unique about verse 9? What's happening here that we haven't seen before? What do you see? Again, this is on page 877 in the Pew Bible. If you don't have one out, I'd love for you to see this with your own eyes. This is a unique intro to a parable. In fact, we don't normally see this explanation. We don't have explanations at the beginning of the parable. Usually the parable's truth, the parable's emphasis, the parable's like shocking point comes near the end. It comes after we've seen some things unfold and after we've contemplated the reality of what Jesus is. But here, Luke, as the gospel writer, says, man, I don't want you to miss this one. He doesn't do this in front of all the parables, but he says on this one, he also told this parable, verse 9, to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and who treated others with contempt. Jesus told this parable especially for the purpose of those who trust in themselves and are self-righteous and treat others with contempt. Jesus was surrounded by religious people who were absolutely convinced that they were fine, but they weren't. Let's look at this. Two men went up to the temple to pray, a Pharisee and a tax collector, verse 10. Now the Pharisee, as you know, was a deeply religious man. He took the Torah very seriously, at least externally he did, and he was highly respected by many people. It was quite normal that he would go up to the temple, it says, go up to the temple, that is, go up to Jerusalem. It sat on sort of a mesa, a tabletop there, and you would ascend to Jerusalem. You go up to the temple. He went up probably at 9 a.m. and 3 o'clock daily to pray. No surprise there. That's what religious men do. The tax collector, though, was also found there. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. Probably the most hated profession of the time. Like this to be a tax collector was not a, to be called a tax collector in the scriptures was not a compliment. Depending on where you were in the scheme of things, it was most often a hated or despised profession, because here's what happened. They made they made deals with Rome, and it was kind of like a pyramid scheme. So some wealthy dude with a lot of land makes a deal with Rome on, say, for the east side of the city or the west side of the city. And then he begins to build out underneath him. He's got like a franchise for tax collecting. And he builds out a pyramid scheme underneath him. And at the very bottom are the guys who tax collect on the streets and who are more accessible and more public. And we can safely assume that this tax collector was more like the despised drug dealer on the street than anything. Don't think of him as a white-collar, highly respected financier. That's not what he is. He's more like a drug dealer. Nobody likes him. And these two men represent the extremes of first century Judaism and the religious culture. So on one hand, you have a highly respected, predictable, religious person. On the other hand, you have a highly despised, easily rejected, who do you think would have a more open line to heaven at the temple that day? Well, the religious guy, of course. That's what's so shocking about this parable. Because that's not what happens. So, yeah, without going too far in, let me just say this. It's entirely possible to be deceived by the mechanisms of religion. It is entirely possible to be deceived by the mechanisms of religion and to convince yourself that you're a good person, to attend church, to go to Sunday school, to give money, to pray, even to receive communion, but to be entirely self-motivated and self-impressed and self-righteous, really, self-righteous and looking down on other people, so much so that there's little or no understanding of God's mercy and God's grace. That's exactly what we see unfolding in front of us with the Pharisee. So those are the two men. And there are two prayers. Verse 11, the Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed like this. Now he stood up and he prayed by himself. It's not such an infraction. In fact, it's not an infraction that he stood up. It was very common for Jews to stand and pray. It was very appropriate. But the key here is in what the text says. He stood by himself and prayed like this, right? It can also be that the language, the by himself could also be rendered, he stood and prayed about himself or to himself even, praying to himself. His prayer is so heavy with self-aggrandizing thoughts that it just never even gets off the ground. The problem is the superiority and pride with which he sets himself apart and prays. Standing by himself, he prayed like this. Let's just stop there, because after he says the word God at the very beginning of his prayer, that's the last time he mentions him. He's so caught up in himself that his prayer, he does the sort of obligatory religious address, God, but then after that, he's off to the races, and he's so impressed with himself, he never mentions God again. I did this, I did that. Count how many I's there are in the text. Five times he says, I. There's really no room for he and God in the same prayer. He glances at God, says Plummer, but contemplates himself. He's really impressed with himself. Really impressed with himself. And his prayer exposes two things: personal superiority and religious accomplishment. Personal superiority and religious accomplishment. Look at verse 11 again. Here's the superiority. I thank you that I'm not like those people. Have you ever thought that about yourself? Man, I'm so thankful I'm not like them. That's not real gratitude. That's not true gratitude. It's just so much superiority going on here. Like, I'm not like an extortioner or unjust or an adulterer or even like this tax collector. I can't even believe he's in the temple right now. You can just feel the superiority. And then the religious gloating in verse 12. Oh, I thank God because I fast twice a week and I give tithes. I mean, you could put it in your sort of, I do this, I do that voice, right? Look, you can just feel the superiority and the religious gloating, and Jesus just lists a couple here as he's building out the story, but no doubt there's a long list of things he's proud of. Both the superiority and the religious gloating are signs, they're symptoms of something much deeper. What is it? What do you think it is? It's a deep sense of pride, right? The sin of pride. In Christianity, pride is identified as the deadliest of the seven deadly sins. It is the essential vice, as C.S. Lewis put it. And Lewis goes on to say, anger and greed and drunkenness and all that stuff are mere flea bites in comparison to pride. It's through pride that the devil became the devil, and pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind. Pride is never content with having what it wants, but rather just having more than the other person. Lewis writes, if we were all equally rich or clever or good-looking, well, would there be nothing to be proud about? Pride is the pleasure of being above someone else, right? So you, me. That's how it works. That's what pride is. Pride is what verse 9 was pointing to. Jesus told this parable, the gospel writer says, to those who are so self-righteous and so full of conceit and so proud of themselves that the counterpart to pride, the twin sister of pride, is to be critical and look down on people and judge them. That's why verse 9 says what it does, and therefore treated others with contempt. Because self-righteousness, just like note to self, sidebar, put it somewhere on an index card or in digital notes, with self-righteousness almost always comes its twin sister, judgment and a critical spirit toward other people. So that's the Pharisee's prayer. He's just full of himself. The tax collector prays very differently, doesn't he? It's much shorter. It's not long and flowery and impressive. It's kind of short and to the point. Let that be a reminder to us how we pray. The tax collector's prayer is very different. He stands far off, probably the outer edge of the court of the Gentiles, because he's just got a profound sense of guilt and shame and unworthiness. So at the temple, he didn't go all the way in. He literally stayed on the fringe, and he's kind of overwhelmed with guilt and shame and unworthiness, all of which are true. The Pharisee stands by himself in superiority. The tax collector stands far away in humility. Verse 13 says, he wouldn't even lift up his eyes to heaven. Now, lifting up your eyes was an important gesture in prayer, right? To physically look up to God in prayer. And if you don't already pray this way, I would commend it to you. You could do it by yourself so you don't feel self-conscious in front of people, but like you just, you know, you're out there and just look up to heaven and feel the smallness, feel your smallness and God's greatness, and open your eyes and pray to the Lord and call on Him and ask Him for help. Psalm 121 says, I lift up my eyes to the hills, right? Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. I'm not praying to the hills. I know better than that. I'm lifting up my eyes to the hills because from there will come my deliverance. God is like beyond the hills. God is the one who's going to, he is the only one who can help me. So I look up, I lift up my eyes, I pray. My physical posture and gestures in prayer are significant. And, but this man knows that. Probably, but he's so ashamed that he won't do it. Like he won't look up. He feels the weight of shame and guilt. He's thinking to himself, I've stolen from my own people. I've stolen from my own family. I've even stolen from friends. The love of money has become so consuming in my heart and soul that I've dehumanized people. I've commodified them. I've sold out my own people. I'm ashamed to even look up at the Lord. Why am I even at the temple? And he's so ashamed that he beats on, look at the next line. He beats on his chest. He's like, oh, what? Who am I? And he's probably even angry with himself and resentful and like, why am I like this? Why am I like this? This is kind of strange to us. This is strange because you and I live in a world where the only people who really beat on their chests are professional football players and basketball players. There's the single beat. You know who that is if you're a basketballer. There's the double beat. You know, if you, you know. But then, and you know who this one is if you're a basketball player. Then there's the King Kong. You know who that is. Just, okay. If you drive the lane and score, or if you're on a football team and you do great, don't do that. Just life hack, tip of the day, just don't do that. It's not, and especially in basketball, because it's not good for you, it's not good for your soul, and it's not good for your team, because you can't get back on defense when you're beating on your chest. Right? Self-glory is just not good for you. I mean, if you make a great shot, then like, let's go, and then turn around and go play. What are you pausing in the middle of a game that's not about you? Oh, but it is about you. So, after beating on his chest for the right reasons, in humiliation, he voices the prayer of verse 13. And this is it. This is the gold. This is the money right here. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. This is how you pray. God, show me mercy. Cry out for mercy. The heart of his prayer is mercy, a cry. Not mercy in the simple sense of compassion, or even mercy rather than well-deserved judgment. That would be good. But there's a richer sense of mercy here. And commentators like to point this out, that the word mercy used here is fairly rare in the New Testament, and it's used in a technical sense. It's tied to the propitiation word group, the wrath of God being assuaged, absorbed, propitiated. One translator wants to write the prayer this way, oh God, be propitiated. Like, let your wrath fall on someone else, not me. Will you please absorb the mercy? Like, by your mercy, will you please absorb the wrath that I deserve? I don't suppose any parables take us up under the shadow of the cross like this one. Very few parables so tightly tie to the cross. This one does. This is a cry for mercy. This is a cry for atonement. This is let your anger be removed from me. This is a beautiful prayer. God, will you please do for me what I cannot do for myself? Will you cover my sins? Will you atone for my sins? So you have two men, two prayers, and two destinies. Verse 14 is so good. You know, this is not a long story. You step back and read it again. It's not a long story. Look at verse 14. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified. Circle that word. Mark it. Highlight it. Underline it. There was only one prayer that was heard that day, and it's the word, and it's the prayer of the one who cried for mercy. I think from the story's perspective, the most important word in the story is justified. From the sinner's perspective, the most important word, of course, is mercy, right? Crying out for mercy. But from the story's perspective, I think the word justified is probably the single most important word in the story. It comes from the justice and righteousness word group. So what's happening here is, Jesus is saying, I'm telling you, that day when those two men left the temple, one of them left righteous, though he feels zero sense of righteousness, though he knows himself to be truly and fully unworthy. One man left righteous. How do you get righteousness like that? How do you get declared righteous? How do you get imputed righteousness? How do you get a righteousness assigned to your account that you're not worthy of? Abraham, the Bible says, believed God. He trusted God by faith, and it was accounted to him as righteousness, Romans chapter 4, or Genesis chapter 15. The Apostle Paul is going to pick up this very idea to build out the doctrine of justification by faith. The whole book of Romans is a build-out of what's here in raw form. So in raw form, Jesus is teaching about how you could get someone else's righteousness, how you could be justified. Paul builds it out in Romans. It's beautiful in Romans. You should go read Romans, dig into that. Romans is about the justification of sinners. This parable is pointing us in no uncertain terms to the all-sufficient work of Jesus on the cross. I mean, remember, these stories are set are nested in a larger gospel story. The gospel story itself is going to keep unfolding, and we're going to find ourselves at the cross. And on that day, when Jesus dies, there's a criminal on both sides. One of them says, "Will you help me?" The other continues to make fun of him. But the one who cries out for mercy, Jesus says, "I'll give that to you. I'll give it to you right now, today. You can experience my mercy. You're going to ride on my credit. You have no other hope but to ride on my righteousness and my credit." So, this, can I just have your attention for another minute? If you're starting to think about Christianity and consider the gospel and understand what church and gospel and Christianity are all about, if you're starting to think about that really seriously for the first time, let me try to summarize it for you in a slide here. I'll go to the next slide. Here's what religion is all about. Religion is about obeying. Like, punctiliously, fastidiously, religiously, obeying perfectly. That's what religion's about. Therefore, that's how I get accepted. That's how I find my goodness. That's how I find my righteousness. The gospel is a complete reversal of that. The gospel says, I am accepted by Jesus. I'm not worthy of it. I shouldn't get it. I don't deserve it. But Jesus, because of his profound love for sinners, and God, because of his profound love, sent Jesus, and he did something for us that we couldn't do for ourselves to demonstrate his love and acceptance of us. I am accepted by Christ, therefore, now I want to obey. And there's a huge difference between those two ways of life. And they're in this story. Like, this is the point of the story. The Pharisee did not leave. The most expected guy to leave church that day with an A-plus and a star and a smile from the rest of those in the temple. Well, what it would have been the Pharisee. That's not the way the story ends. I tell you, Jesus said, this man, the tax collector, the most unworthy, went down, went home, justified, declared righteous, right with God. So then verse 14 adds, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and the one who humbles himself will be exalted. This is not just a life principle for your calendar for 2024. Be humble, and then you'll be exalted. So the best way to get glory is to be humble first, and then you'll be exalted. That's not what this means. This is a way of talking about the gospel. The person who loves to glory in himself will be utterly humiliated in the end. And the person who's willing to be humiliated in confession, in repentance, in vulnerability, in acknowledgement, in repentance, that person can throw themselves on the mercy of Jesus and he will take care of the rest. Donna and Bella, is Bella still in here? Where is Bella? Bella, thank you for the courage that it took to get up there. And we love your story. Donna, thank you for being so honest and saying, man, I came to the end of myself. And I have nowhere else to go. And so I'm going to throw myself on the mercy of Jesus. If you're thinking about this, you should talk to one of them. You should talk to other disciples in this room. You should talk to us as pastors. We would love to point you to Christ. You could go public with baptism, but you shouldn't receive baptism until you first received the mercy of Christ to save you.